You are listening to a free version of the Majority Report with Sam Steeter. To support this show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeter.
The destiny of America is always safer in the hands of the people than in the conference rooms of any elite.
Sam Steeter.
They are unanimous in their hate for me, and I welcome their hatred.
We must guard against the acquisition of unwarranted influence, whether sought or unsought, by the military-industrial complex.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeter.
And I get the feeling you've been cheated.
It is Thursday, August 13, 2015. My name is Sam Steeter. This is the four-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On the program today, Sharon Lerner, writing in The Intercept on DuPont and the chemistry of deception. Also on the program today, Black Lives Matters interrupts Jeb Bush's campaign event. And a quite a heated argument ensues between the protesters and the Jeb Bush supporters. Meanwhile, Chelsea Manning facing an open-ended solitary confinement because she had a copy of the Vanity Fair cover featuring Caitlyn Jenner in her possession. Also, Dr. Ben Carson, now one of the front runners, but for how long since it's been revealed that as a doctor, he too used fetal tissue for research. Ben Carson's explanation as to why his use of this fetal tissue was different is it's gonna be fascinating again to watch how that goes, because it is you know, whenever their politics, and I do mean their, bumps up against the real world, it is always interesting to watch the right turn themselves into pretzels to sort of justify why they don't hold someone to account. Meanwhile, CBO comes out with a report on the implications of the sequester, and it remains shocking. And then it's also shocking about how undiscussed it is in our system. And finally, a story that I know is going to be music to Matt's ears. That is a study which shows just how painful it is to have a child, particularly the first child. And I don't mean to deliver one. I mean to actually just have one. But we'll get to that in a moment. Stuff. Now, ladies and gentlemen, we contemplated shutting down the show today because it is, as you know, it is, well, as you may not know, it's Michael's birthday today.
Happy birthday, Michael.
Happy birthday, Michael.
Thanks, guys.
And when Michael heard that we were not having cupcakes today in the office, he decided to not come in until like just 2 minutes before. Now, I've been through this. Of course, I have a 10-year-old girl now, and so I've been through this many times, and I know how difficult it is for someone on their birthday to have to go to school or to work or to camp or something like that. And so I certainly trying to be very sympathetic, right? Very sympathetic.
The same tantrum continues.
And so I just want to say, Michael, I'm sorry we don't have cupcakes yet. And you know how you only want to have one sweet thing a day, and I just thought it would ruin your lunch if we had it before noon.
I appreciate it. Can I have a beer?
Michael's going to drink alcohol during the show. All right, we're going to take a quick break. When we come back, we'll be talking to Sharon Lerner. We should play Michael's birthday song. Here it is. It's my party, and I cry if I want to die, if I want to die, if I want to die.
You would cry too if it happened to me. I actually got one.
All right, folks, we're going to take a quick break, and when we return, Sharon Lerner on DuPont and the chemistry of deception. We are back. Sam Seder on the Majority Report on the phone. It is a pleasure to welcome to the program Brooklyn-based journalist and author Sharon Lerner. And on her piece, DuPont and the Chemistry of Deception in The Intercept, which I believe is partially done in conjunction with the Nation Investigative Journalism Fund. Welcome to the program, Sharon.
Thanks for having me. Yeah, it's the investigative fund. Yep.
And let me just, I should say, just as a full disclosure, as I was reading your piece, much of this I was at least somewhat familiar with because I do a radio program with Mike Papantonio, who not only did he and Bobby Kennedy working on a deal, a case against DuPont, win a $381 million settlement in Spelter, West Virginia, on dealing with a zinc smeltering plant. But I believe that firm is also working on the C8 cases, the Teflon cases that are coming out, as you write, in September. And just as a matter of full disclosure, I don't know much more other than I think an interview I've done on this program maybe a year or two ago about this topic. But I just wanted to get that out there because your story is really stunning. I mean, I read stories like this and it just I don't like to swear on air, and I won't, but it makes me wonder what in the world is wrong with people when you read something like this. Tell us, you start with the story of a guy named Ken Wamsley. Just tell us about Ken Wamsley's situation right now.
Sure. Well, Ken Wamsley is a former DuPont employee. He lives in Parkersburg, West Virginia. And he used to be a lab analyst there in what was called the Teflon division. And he works, has some exposure to this chemical through his work. And he developed a disease called ulcerative colitis. That condition, which is like a bowel disease, sometimes leads to rectal cancer, and which is what happened for him. And so I interviewed him about his work at DuPont and also his condition now. He's pretty ill. And then, I kind of led the story with him because One, the cases you've been talking about are a bunch of personal injury cases. They're about 3,500 or so that are coming up, the first of them, as you mentioned, in September. And these are cases that are coming out of this class action suit in West Virginia that involve people who lived near the DuPont plant there in Parkersburg. And it's basically people who lived in these water districts that had a significant amount of this chemical C8 we've been talking about. And so the people who live in this water district who had this stuff in their water, if they developed any of six conditions that a group of scientists determined were linked to the chemical, then they would be allowed to sue. And so these are the cases that are coming up now. There are people who we know were exposed to a certain level of this chemical who developed any of these six conditions, and it's ulcerative colitis, preeclampsia, kidney cancer, testicular cancer, there are a couple others. So he's one of those people, and, you know, the reason I led with him is because I feel like in these completely overwhelming legal messes that, you know, with lots of acronyms and chemical names and companies involved and complicated laws, state, you know, everything. It's just complete tangle of, you know, words and institutions and all this. It really comes down to cases like this, people, you know, and you want to think about why do any of us care about any of this? And I think whether it's Ken Walmsley or someone else, we care because, you know, because ultimately these chemicals have the power to hurt us. And, you know, what does that look like? Well, for Ken Walmsley, it looks like being very restricted in his movements. He can't, he doesn't go out much anymore. He has a colostomy bag. He can't sleep well, you know, and it's just one person, but it's a way of understanding what potentially, you know, chemicals, what they can do and how they could affect.
And I have to say, I know someone who has ulcerative colitis. It is an incredibly difficult disease, particularly when you have it as acutely as Ken Walmsley seems to have. But what your story also tells for me, and we're gonna basically go to the beginning of it. But what your story also relates to me is that Ken Walmsley is, in many respects, and people like him may very well be the sort of the canaries in the coal mine on one level in terms of the health implications of this. It also strikes me as what this story really tells is it really lifts the veil on this notion of just what people are capable of doing when they feel they are in some way shrouded or, I guess, at arm's length because of a veil of being part of a company or a corporation. But before we get to those parts of it, because some of that element, it comes out in the course of, I guess, the discovery in these personal injury cases. Tell us what C8 is. And I should warn people at home, be prepared to be disturbed because you all have had these products in your house. You're going to find out that you've had them, that you have it in your blood, too. What is C8?
So C8 is a processing aid. It's a chemical that's used in the production of Teflon, and that's kind of what it's famous for. In fact, though, it's used in thousands of products. The exposure, you're right, that we all have it, 99.7% of Americans have some level of this in their blood, according to the latest figures I've seen from the CDC. So it is a man-made chemical. It didn't exist before it was created years ago. So, and it's been on the market since, I believe, the early 1950s. So we know that it's in our blood because it was created and produced and put into the environment and absorbed by us in various ways. I should say, though, that Teflon is not the major source of exposure. I don't think people fully understand why it's in everyone. I should say that. But they know. And also, it's not just in humans and in breast milk and in umbilical cord blood. And in it's also in animals, wildlife. And it's also in ocean waters. And it's also in many places throughout the world. But, you know, so we don't fully understand it. It is, I think, at least in part due to exposure to products, but I think that we know that the biggest source, bigger than Teflon, is a stain repellent coating for carpets. There's Stainmaster, there are other, it's also in the Scotchgard and similar chemicals in Gore-Tex and sort of, water repellent fabrics, all that kind of stuff. So I, you know, people do think that is one of the ways that we get it into our blood. And I personally have tossed my Teflon pans. I think it's the judgment call, but you know, I think, again, it's not the, number one source of exposure, we think.
So we have this. We know it's all of this exposure, though, leads to the development of this C8 because it doesn't occur in nature, and so it's everywhere. Tell us what is, and at the time that this was introduced, back in the 40s, the late 40s, early 50s, what is the process? I mean, I develop a chemical like this. How rigorous is the federally mandated, at least in the United States, the mandated testing to see if this this product is safe? And how much of it is sort of government oversight in terms of testing this, or simply we're going to trust a corporation, in this case DuPont, to tell us what they've found?
Well, I mean, when they introduced the chemical, it was perfectly legal to do it without, you know, knowing what its health consequences are. And that's still largely the case. You know, the way we do things here, essentially, in short, is to assume, you know, sort of innocent till proven guilty for chemicals. That is not the way things are done in Europe. You know, what we do say is, what the EPA says is, you know, you are obligated to report any evidence you have that it might be harmful, you know, and it doesn't have to be conclusive. It can just be suggestive. You need to do that. But it's very hard for them to make sure that people are doing that because they, you know, you have to submit, you know, your evidence if you have it. So if you get busted for not doing that, you can get in trouble. And that's, in fact, what happened with DuPont. In 2005, I believe they were fined. It was the biggest fine in EPA history at the time, and they were fined for withholding some evidence that you know, C8 was harmful to animals. And some of that, and that they knew that it had spread beyond the plant. There are a couple things that they were being fined for, but it's worth noting that. The fine, you know, it was pretty small compared to, you know, their profits. So it doesn't really, it's not a great deterrent. It doesn't really work that well.
Right. I mean, it is essentially, when you look at the fine in terms of their operating expenses, it's equivalent to keeping a couple of lights on in one of their factories. I mean, that's a bit of an exaggeration, but it's simply built, it's baked into the cake. We have operating expenses, and one of them is labor and scientists and facilities, and one is the fine, I mean, apparently, that we have a sense that we're ultimately going to pay. So let's talk about how these companies, I mean, the most obvious way a company would figure out that their chemical has the potential of being dangerous to the population at large is that there is hints that it may be dangerous to people who are working with it on a daily basis, right? I mean, because these are the people who are coming into contact with it the most. And so let's go back to when Through discovery, I guess, the process of legal discovery, which is the sort of the, I guess the, I don't know if I would call it the prologue, but of a civil litigation, but it is the first process where essentially the company has to release all its documents, and a law firm goes in there and sort of forensically checks all of the documents the company has in terms of internal communications. And you write, through this process of legal discovery, DuPont employees for many years, there are hundreds of internal communications revealing that DuPont employees for many years suspected that C8 was harmful, yet continued to use it. Give us a sense of when those first internal documents start to reveal that there was concern amongst DuPont employees and management that C8 was potentially toxic to human beings.
Well, I mean, it was certainly a gradual process. There is a note in 1954 about this possible toxicity. And, you know, it sort of from then built. I mean, I should say that their experiments were, for the most part, you know, they were looking at health effects in lab animals. They looked at the toxicity to the livers of dogs and rats, a lot of experiments on rats. And ultimately, they were also observing effects in their workers. And they did see that the chemical accumulated in their livers and sometimes caused workers to have abnormal liver function tests. You know, and, you know, there was some internal dispute as to whether or not that was, in fact, a health effect. And because, you know, the kind of reason that it wasn't exactly a health effect, that was part of their rationale for not reporting the abnormal liver stuff to the EPA at the time.
Now, has the EPA
also?
Let me ask you this, Sharon, if I could. Has the EPA made a determination as to whether or not their analysis that this abnormal liver function that they perceived as a result of C8 but did not perceive as to be a health effect, has the EPA made any type of, ruling or judgment as to whether or not that type of liver dysfunction qualifies as at least sort of prima facie or enough evidence to report to the FDA? I mean, to the FDA or to the EPA?
Yeah, I don't know specifically what they've said about the liver stuff. I know that they're very that they're very clear that they, even if it's not conclusive, that they want you to report it if it's suggestive of harm. So I would assume that that would fall under that. But I just wanted to say that I'm not sure you realize that the piece that you read that's in the Intercept now is the first of three. So this will be a series continuing through next week. So this is the first piece, and the second and third piece will go, obviously, into greater detail, both about regulation, but about, you know, we've been talking a little bit about internal documents, and that certainly will be a big part of what's to come.
Well, give us a little bit of a glimpse into what we're going to see in those pieces as well, as if you will, because you talk about the history of DuPont. They had a little bit of an issue with leaded gasoline, is my understanding. Mm-hmm. Walk us through that and the industrial chemicals.
It's a huge company. It began in, I can't remember the exact date, but 19th century, you know, as a manufacturer of gunpowder and explosives. And that's how they got their start. They manufacture the leaded gasoline, which no longer in the market. They've actually had a number of kind of environmentally potent kind of explosive products. One was leaded gasoline, which did cause mental illness in some of the workers who worked with it. They worked with some rubber additives or something that were turning workers blue, but they recovered, but they turned blue. They worked with Freon. They had involvement with the Manhattan Project. So they're a huge company, and they're they've worked with pesticides. They deal with things that are potent and sometimes dangerous, and they've had lots of as a consequence, it can be a dirty business. So what they did, to their credit, was they were the first company that I've been able to find that came up with an in-house toxicology unit, this laboratory called Haskell Labs that they tasked with checking out the safety of their products, both for workers and people who would buy them, and to see if the chemicals that they were making and using had health effects. So they were proactive in that way and set up Haskell Labs. But the problem is, I think this was a problem back when they set up the lab in 35, and it's still a problem that, there's just inherent conflicts. When you are studying your own products, the decisions that you make and the research that you do has an impact on your bottom line. And, it becomes a public company. They have, by law, obligations to their shareholders, and these things end up coming in conflict, and I think that's what we're looking at. That, on the one hand, a company needs to make money, and on the other, there are real liabilities that come along with a business like chemicals. And so I think they throughout their history have been wrestling with this.
Well, quoting from your piece, one of Haskell's first employees, a pathologist named Wilhelm Hooper, cracked the bladder cancer case that DuPont was looking at in terms of bladder cancers that were cropping up amongst many of their dye workers. And he cracked this case by developing a model of how the dye chemicals led to the disease, but the company forbade him from publishing some of his research. And according to public health scholar David Michaels, fired him in 1937 before going on to use the chemical in question for decades more after the fact.
Right. So, you mentioned it, but I should, add that that's obviously David Michaels' research. He wrote a wonderful book called Doubt Is Their Product, which was about different consulting companies that kind of are different ways that people, companies and their consultants spend scientific information and, to help them continue to profit. And he used this as an example, which I thought was a great one.
And then you write, in 1954, a DuPont employee named R.A. Dixon noted that he had received an inquiry regarding C8's possible toxicity. And within 7 or 8 years later, they already determined that this was a chemical that needed to be handled with extreme care, which in and of itself, I guess, is not, atypical. I would imagine you want to do that for most chemicals. But this is the this is the beginning of them sort of this process of, it seems to me, DuPont employees, some of them, finding like a thread, if you will, and saying, hey, you know what? This is a thread that looks like we should pull on. And then basically DuPont as a corporation says, no, we're not going to pull on that. In fact, let's just snip it right here and continue on with this product.
Well, sure. I mean, there are lots of decisions, you make about, right. Are you going to pursue something that could be damning? Probably not. But in some cases, there are judgment calls throughout this. And I would say that some within the company, it's a huge company. It's a lot of people. It's a lot of divisions. They have legal. They have they have the lab, they have all, the people doing the engineers, the development, the lab analysts, whatever. So, there was a variety of opinions within the company, and it's interesting to read about that. As I've been reading through all these documents, what a company does in the end, doesn't always reflect all the people within the company. So there were people who were saying, hey, let's do this. Look out. Is this dangerous? You know, and who believed they were doing the right thing. But in the end, it's a huge conglomerate that, you know, makes complicated decisions based on a lot of input.
And, you know, and I want to get to that. Let's touch on that. Like, what, you know, how I have no doubt that when you have a company that size, I mean, heck, even a company the size of the one that I have to make this podcast radio program, there's often dissent. But ultimately, how do we define what is the company? Or is that part of the problem? Mm-hmm. You know what I'm saying? Is it
right.
Where is
yes.
What is it that the company is doing? And what do we mean when we say that? Because you also write that because of its toxicity, C8 disposal presented a problem. In the 60s, the company buried 200 drums of the chemical on the banks of the Ohio River near the plant. And then you found an internal DuPont document from 75 about Teflon waste disposal, which detailed how the company began packing the waste in drums, shipping the drums out on barges out to sea, and dumping them in the ocean, adding stones to make the drums sink. This is, I mean...
Right. And the thing, yeah, to note, you know, so ocean dumping at the time in the 60s was legal. And so, yeah, what they were doing, we don't know exactly how much of this stuff they... disposed of this way, but basically they realized, you know, this is a little bit too toxic to put in the town dump or whatever. We are going to dump it directly into the ocean. And at the time, until 1972, there was a Ocean Dumping Act or something that made it illegal. And so until then, they were dumping it right directly into the ocean.
But let me ask you this. If I am aware that something is too toxic to dump here near me, and I want to go out into the ocean to dump it, does that not cross the threshold where I should be informing either the EPA or the FDA, EPA not at that time, obviously, the FDA, that, hey, this thing is at least toxic enough that we feel like we should be dumping it in the middle of the ocean?
Seems like a problem. I agree. That's why I put it in there.
Yeah. Okay. I'm just curious because
do I think you would like? No. That's why I put it in there. You know. Right. Yeah. Ocean dumping huge amounts of a toxic chemical in the ocean. Good idea. Not to me, but you know, legal. Yes.
But legal to dump it. But I mean, does that? Do you have a sense of whether or not that's indicative of enough awareness of the toxicity levels to report that under the sort of the FDA threshold?
Well, it wasn't an FDA threshold. It's an EPA threshold. And no, I don't think they were obligated to report it.
Okay. Interesting. And so as we move forward, in 1978, DuPont alerted its workers to the results of a study done by 3M showing that employees were accumulating C8 in their blood. At what point did DuPont decide we should not be exposing pregnant women who work for us to this?
Right. So that was after the 3M study came out. So 3M did this study with rats and came up with that rats who were exposed to the chemical were more likely to have pups that were that had facial deformities. And so they, you know, later there was some dispute as to whether or not the results of that experiment were valid. I think that whether or not they were valid, the company went, 3M went to the EPA and explained the study and told them, reported the results that they're obligated to do. And at the time, DuPont also had some interaction with the EPA and discussed the results of this study. I can't remember if it was in person or through letters, but what happened was they also realized that it would be wise to look at their own exposed workers, women, pregnant women who were exposed, and found that one or possibly two of them out of a group of 10, it was somewhere between 8 and 10 women who were pregnant. There were one and possibly two babies that had facial deformities as well. And so that was evidence that they also have had evidence because they, at the time, took blood from the babies and from the workers. And they realized that there was this chemical in both the mothers and in the newborn babies. So in doing that, they had the first evidence that C8 crossed the placental barrier in humans. And so that was a, kind of a huge discovery, but that was what they did not report to the EPA and what they ended up getting fined about, one of the things they ended up getting fined over later in 2005.
And they, but they did basically after finding that there was a 1 in 4, 1 in 5. I mean, I guess 2 out of 8 or 2 out of 10 chance of deformities with a child from a pregnant woman exposed to that stuff. They did basically say no more pregnant women working in this division, and
yes,
that's what takes us back to Ken Wamsley.
Sure. Yeah.
Well, he comes back. He ends up working in that division.
He worked in the lab.
And didn't he? Yep. Didn't he say at one point in your piece? He said, "You know, I asked, hey, what's going on with the pregnant women that you're moving out of this division? Is it okay for us to be here?"
Yes. And he said that they said it won't hurt the men. That's right.
And So flash forward to us, how is it that it came out in 2005? I mean, how did this stuff, how was it that the EPA ultimately end up providing a fine for DuPont for not reporting in the way that they should have reported?
Well, the information about all of this, about really the vast majority of all this that we're talking about, was brought to the EPA and to other agencies by an attorney named Robert Ballot, who was representing some people in who were exposed in West Virginia. And at the time, he was also representing a farmer whose cows had been exposed and died. The farmer had leased or sold part of his land to DuPont, and their property was adjacent to his, and they dumped some of the chemical onto the property. And afterward, the farmer, whose name was Tennant, his cows died. And so Ballot represented Tennant, and they sued DuPont, and DuPont settled with them. But in the process of their suing, and then Ballot ended up representing a whole group, which became a class of people in the area who were exposed to their drinking water. It was his litigation that turned up all these documents.
So,
and he's also presiding over the class, the suits that are upcoming in September.
Interesting. And so, your next two pieces, just give us a little bit of a preview. You did slightly already, but give us a little more of a preview of those two pieces, and people can check them out, obviously, at The Intercept.
Okay. So the second one will be all about sort of the lawsuits and the very strange process that that led to, you know, uncovering all this that we've been talking about, and sort of this dawning realization among the local communities that they've been exposed. And then the third one is all about it's all about regulators and how this went down, and really is, in a way, continuing to go down in terms of, you know, how to figure out what's safe and what's not safe now that it's out kind of in a widespread way.
Is in the course of reporting on this, I mean, did you develop an opinion as to what would be a better system, or what is, I mean, what is the fundamental problem, I guess, we have that for half a century a company can put out and work with a chemical that they know to some degree or another is either they know it's either toxic or they know it is potentially toxic enough so that there should be more research, but they're not going forward with it. And at one point,
I would say that, you know, the Toxin Substances Control Act, TSCA, is, you know, up for reauthorization and has been for a while, and people are debating it. And, like, that is at the center of this problem, because essentially we've grandfathered in. We've just, you know, I was saying that when DuPont introduced the chemical, it was perfectly legal to do that, because we weren't at all regulating chemicals. I mean, since then we have TSCA, but what it says, like, you know, that there are tens of thousands of existing chemicals that were in existence when the law passed, but, like, they were just done. And then, you know, so that there wasn't anything particular that was going to be done to these chemicals that were already in existence, and that the ones, again, with the ones that are being introduced, the burden is still on regulators to show that they're unsafe, instead of placing the burden, as Europe does, on the users and manufacturers to show that they're safe before they start using and manufacturing them. So to flip it in that way, I think, would go a long way to solving the problem.
With those existing chemicals, does the company have any responsibility to go back and basically say, hey, you know, here's a study that we had from 1955, let's say, that indicated or that basically should have set off a red flag and said more study is warranted? Do they have any obligation under existing law to do that, or can they just basically ignore it?
They have an obligation under existing law. There are huge fixes, and as I mentioned before, you know, the companies, you know, are also bound in this way to, like, be responsible to their stockholders, sort of like within the limits of the law. And I think that, you know, the lawyers, the attorneys that are about to go forward on these cases would say is that they weren't within the limits of the law, and we'll see if they win on that. But whether or not they were within the limits of the law allows far too much, you know, in terms of, you know, different ways to get around the, you know, weak regulations that already, that we have. So I feel like there's a lot of room for improvement, and I feel like it's a great moment to think about the TSCA reauthorization, and also to think about, as consumers, I mean, the other thing that we can do is, you know, exert real pressure on companies, you know, to one, to know what, figure out what they're doing, but two, to say, you know, if you are doing this, we will not buy your stuff, or, you know, or conversely, you know, a company that makes the concerted effort not to use these chemicals and to see if they're, you know, to make products that don't contain these kinds of things, to say, you know what, we will, you know, we'll follow you where you go. This matters to us. So I think that part of the process is going, you know, trying to understand what's happened and what's happening all around us is not just, you know, the only chemical in, you know, this is one of many chemicals.
Right.
And so to say, like, try to get a better handle on what's in the environment around us, and then through all the various ways, you know, in terms of the law and in terms of using our powers as consumers to exert our, you know, our opinion that it's not okay and that we will do what we can to make sure that we're not exposed to them.
Indeed. Well, I'm a little skeptical about the power of a consumer to react to something, you know, that is now in all our books. But
it's not all that. It's not all. It's not all that we need to do much more. But given that, you know, the limits of, you know, we should have done better with TSCA in the first place.
Right.
Reauthorized a better bill a long time
ago.
All that is true. At the same time, you know, given the state of Congress, it's not going to look the way we want it to look.
Indeed.
I think you know that. So you do what you can.
Indeed. Sharon Lerner, the piece is DuPont and the Chemistry of Deception, the first of three in a series at The Intercept. We will link to it at majority.fm. Thanks so much for your time today. Really
Thank
appreciate
it. Thank you so much. I really appreciate it. Okay,
bye-bye.
Take care.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
All right, folks. Unbelievable. Unbelievable. And, you know, look, it is one thing to say, like, yes, we should register our issues with DuPont. But in the context of this, as a consumer, it is problematic. And, yes, and this is why it is very hard. And this dynamic where it is contingent upon regulatory agencies to prove that a product is unsafe is such a high bar. And this is why you hear stories like this, where a company for decades is producing a chemical that it has every reason to believe, at the very least, warrants real and sustained studies. You don't dump this stuff in the middle of the ocean because you think, it's probably fine.
What the hell?
This is why when people freak out about a company like Monsanto, it's hard to argue. It's hard to argue it because at the end of the day, ultimately, the responsibility, at least in our system, for reporting that there is a problem usually lies with people who have a vested interest in not reporting the problem. And when you look into stories like this, and frankly, you know, I think I am probably more sensitive to it because I have reported on these stories and interviewed attorneys like the ones involved in this case who have found and participated in the discovery process. You know, some of the quotes in this where a lawyer is brought in for DuPont to tell them internally what they should and should not be putting in writing. And then apparently didn't take his own advice and was talking about the poop quote. This is a quote. The poop 3M sells us that we put it in, do I still have that?
Poopy, poopy, poop.
That we dump into the Ohio River. I mean, it continually blows my mind that there are people who work in these companies. I don't know if it's something that happens in a corporate culture or what, but who are willing to say, like, look, at the end of the day, let's just wait till we get sued. I mean, these are quotes from their internal documents. I find it hard to do less than a 40-minute show, I feel like, and it's not... It's not going to be detrimental to anybody's health. People probably don't even want an hour-long show. But the idea that people could be working in these corporations
I
and
feel
saying
a
like,
fiduciary responsibility
honestly,
to a full show.
Honestly,
on the other
I
hand,
think it's very hard. I think it's very hard for most of us to contemplate that there could be people who make these type of decisions and sleep at night. And walk amongst us like they're normal human beings. And I think it's just very hard. I think that when we contemplate that there are bad people out there, we presume that they're wearing a uniform of our of a country that we're enemies with, or they're driving around in pickup trucks with mounted machine guns. It's very hard for us to contemplate that there could be people who are this ruthless, but I guess wear velvet gloves, essentially. All right, we got to take a break, head into the fun half of the program. I don't know. This gets me just I read stuff like this, and, you know, I mean.
It reminds me of yesterday. That's why I wanted to book her.
Right.
You know, because of the story about the heroic woman at the FDA. Unfortunately, I forget her name at the moment. But, yeah, obviously this isn't specific to DuPont. Nassim Taleb wrote in one of his books that people should – the way, like, we've decided certain things are, like, socially unacceptable on some level, like – you know, I don't know. I don't know what a good example is. Spitting or saying, or even in some circles, saying something overtly racist or misogynist. He was like, we need to start treating people who are, as an example, lobbying for a tobacco company or doing fake PR for DuPont should be treated in the same sort of socially sanctioned way. It's
yes.
Interesting.
Yes. I mean, I think there's, I mean, you know. And we can say, yes, I'm sure there are great people at DuPont who are doing wonderful things. I'm sure I've seen the commercials where the scientist says, you know, my mom is developing or the kid says, my mom is developing something that's going to. And I have no doubt. But somewhere in that corporate structure, there are people who are making these decisions. And it's not the ones they put on the TV to say, I'm here because I love to help people. Well, that may be the case. And you may go through your whole career working for one of these companies and not realize just because you're not on the, hey, is this the, is, am I working with a chemical that isn't safe beat? And you're not the one putting in the report that gets ignored. And then you're asking yourself, okay, here's my opportunity. Do I make a stand? And I look around at the society we have where, you know, you look at whistleblowers with the government, even the government, their lives get ruined. Am I going to make a stink about this at DuPont, essentially kill my career? We just bought a house. I got a mortgage. My kid's got to go to school. My kid's got a medical issue. My wife lost her job, or my husband lost his job. And then you're just like, well, you know, F it. Maybe I'll transfer out of this division and just go to a different division and just leave this behind me. All right. Let's take a break. Folks, you can support this program, this toxic-free program, by becoming a member at majority.fm or join the majorityreport.com. You can also support this program by, if you drink coffee and you want to make sure that everybody who delivers that coffee into your tummy gets a fair wage, and you want to support this program, go to justcoffee.coop. That's COOP. I know people, that sort of freaks people out. What is that? Dot co-op. Is that, well, it's, that's what it is. Dot co-op. And use the coupon code majority to get 10% off. Also, if you buy crap from Amazon, the least you can do is to strip Jeff Bezos of a couple of dollars and buy it through our link at majorityreportkickback.com. Click on the link, bookmark it, always buy your Amazon crap through that. We get a little kickback. And don't forget, what is that?
Strip Jeff Bezos of a couple of dollars.
Oh, yeah.
Should be used regularly.
I've reintroduced that.
I like that.
That's from back in the old days.
Oh, I haven't heard it.
Also, if you have the moment, give us a review on iTunes. majority.fm/review. If everybody gave us a review, that would be on the show. That we would, I mean, that listened to this program. My gosh. We would have a lot of reviews. All right. Be right back. 646-257-3920. 646-257-3920 is the number. Folks, it's Michael's birthday. So, I don't know. We may have to end really early because...
Thank you.
Mike, it's...
Indeed.
It's like Milo. Like,
bye, everybody.
Tell Milo to
have
go.
Have a great second half.
Milo, you got to go to camp. It's my birthday. Okay. Can I watch a movie today? Can I
watch some more of maybe some?
Can I watch
some rosé?
I'm trying to think of what she wants to watch. I can't remember.
What does she want to watch? Oh,
some like inappropriate TV show.
So tired.
Yeah, I am. Believe me. Oh. We will get to that study. What is the worst thing you can go through in terms of science? Divorce? Job loss? Or the birth of your first child? We'll be right back after this.